First speaker is going to be Sarah Rasmussen. She's been with EPA Osworth since 1989 and is the team leader for the RCRA Reuse, and Brownfield Prevention Initiative and the RCRA Corrective Action Program. She coordinates with experts in EPA and state cleanup programs to identify innovative and green approaches that can be applied at land revitalization projects. Previously, she managed the development of regulatory, economic, and risk analysis and has served as a branch manager at EPA. She's also spent several years as a senior legislative staff in Congress and directed science and environmental policy projects at a small consulting firm. Our next speaker would be Penelope McDaniel. She's an environmental scientist with EPA Osworth with over 10 years experience at EPA. She was previously a remedial project manager for EPA's Region 9 San Francisco office. In addition, Penelope led the development of the Clean Up Clean Air Initiative with the goal of to encourage, facilitate, and support diesel emissions and greenhouse gas reduction technologies and practices at Superfund cleanup and redevelopment sites. She has also led the development of Osworth's new initiative, Repowering America's Land, renewable energy on contaminated lands and mining sites, which encourages, facilitates, and supports the development of renewable energy facilities on EPA track sites, such as Superfund, RCRA, brownfields, and mining sites across the country. Additionally, she has experience working with EPA's Air Division, and Penelope holds a bachelor's and master's of science from the University of San Francisco. Our third speaker will be Carlos Pachon. His overall focus is on identifying and advancing best practices and new technologies in cleaning up contaminated sites. He generates and manages much of the available knowledge and information on the use of technologies in Superfund and provides site-specific support through the Brownfields and Land Revitalization Technology Support Center. He is currently engaged in helping define Osworth's green remediation strategy, which is going to be the topic of his presentation. In recent years, he's also served as Deputy Director for Environmental Reviews with the United States Trade Representative and worked as a Special Assistant to EPA Administrator. Previous to EPA, he served as a forecast hydrologist with the NRSC Snow Survey Program. He has a BS from Colorado State in Watershed Management and also graduate degrees in Environment and Business Management from Duke and Georgetown, respectively. Our fourth speaker is Deb Goldblum. She's worked in EPA's Philadelphia. She works in EPA's Philadelphia office, Region 3, in the RCRA Corrective Action Program, and she's done so for 16 years. She is currently the RCRA Revitalization Coordinator and is a key contributor to the national effort to integrate green remediation into the cleanup programs. She has worked on several notable projects, including the RCRA Groundwater Handbook, and is co-leading the development of measures to assess the status of land use at cleanup sites. Prior to joining EPA, Ms. Goldblum taught geology at Temple University and LaSalle University. She has BS in geology from Haverford College and an MS in geology from Temple University. And one last time, I'll remind everybody to please put your phone on mute. If your phone does not have a mute button, you can use *6 to mute. And I'll turn it over to our first presenter, Sarah.
Thank you very much. Again, my name is Sarah Rasmussen, and I work in the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act program, or the RCRA program. And the reason why I'm going first is that I'm going to present the bigger picture, or provide the landscape, if you will, of land revitalization and how sustainable approaches and green approaches fit into it. We've heard a lot about green remediation, and there's several different ways that you can package that. First of all, though, I thought it would be interesting to go back and look at what some of the different definitions of sustainability are, since sustainability is often mentioned in the concept of green remediation and is often discussed as a goal of what people would like to achieve in their projects. On page 2, I have 2 definitions there. One is from an executive order by the president in 2007, which means that says sustainability is to create and maintain conditions under which human and nature can exist in productive harmony that permit fulfilling the social, economic, and other requirements of the present and future generations. Our EPA sustainability website has a similar definition, which says that sustainability means meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. And in the big context, that's what we can be striving for when we talk about land revitalization projects, when we talk about cleanup projects. On page 3 is a diagram that many people have seen before. It discusses the 3 circles that are often referred to when talking about sustainability: economic, environmental, and social, and finding the balance between all 3 of those needs so that you can create a project that does not have adverse impacts on, particularly on one of those circles. We've defined sustainable green remediation as considering a broad array of environmental factors and community impacts during all phases of a cleanup project in a land revitalization project. That would be demolition, waste remediation, design and construction, and reuse, in order to maximize social and environmental and economic benefits associated with the project. So moving on to page 4, this is just a quick note to say that we have support for sustainable approaches in several of our EPA planning documents and our own strategic documents. And one of the things that's very exciting about a land revitalization project is that land revitalization, the concept of that, is very bipartisan in the sense of we have support from that from most fields, and this is a project or an emphasis that's going to continue on. Moving on to page 5, be a little bit more specific about what we're talking about. When we talk about a cleanup project or a land revitalization project, there's several different factors we could consider. We can look at the different media, such as air and water, and the impact on those, and on the land and the ecosystems. We consider how much materials are used and how much waste is generated. We can look at the energy use, which is gaining a lot more visibility these days. And we can look at long-term land stewardship. All of these pieces can be applied to a project throughout all phases. And if we move on to slide 6, this is another way to look at a land revitalization project, where you look at the 4 phases, starting from deconstruction, demolition, and removal of the existing structures to the actual remediation activities to clean up any hazardous constituents that are there or address them, moving through to the design and construction of the structures for the new use. And then finally, the last bubble there is the actual next follow-on use of that property. Is that being done in a sustainable way? So we can take the concepts from slide 5 and apply them to each one of the bubbles here in slide 6. So if we were to do that and move on to slide 7, for instance, in the deconstruction and demolition phase, what that might mean, some examples of that could be, is to really look at reusing and recycling demolition construction materials. We have really grown in the last few years on finding ways to match up buyers and sellers of those materials, of setting up forums for people to advertise materials, and we have some great resources at the end. What you see here on the right bottom, the little picture there, Reuse Your Resources, is a pamphlet that we've done that discusses that, and I recommend all of you to look at that if you're interested. It's a very good general discussion. Another concept that you can use is to reuse materials on the site whenever possible so you don't have to truck them off. Consider the future uses and the possibility of reusing existing sites. One concept is to consider is preserving historic buildings and historic structures in particular. The concept of using cleaner fuels and increasing your energy efficiency we'll see throughout the entire phases project here. Retaining native vegetation, we're learning, is even more important than we had thought before, and protecting water resources from runoff and contamination. Moving on to slide 8, if we were to move on into the cleanup remediation and waste management phase, Carlos is going to speak quite a bit more about this, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it, and I think Debbie Goldblum is as well. But again, it talks about using cleaner fuels, it talks about improving your energy efficiency, talks about considering more efficient approaches, considering the impact on water and air, and employing practices that restore your soil health and ecosystems. If we were moved to page 9, slide 9, design for construction, now there's a tremendous amount of opportunity here. And we're not going to discuss this too much today in this seminar, but we will discuss it in other seminars. So I wanted to touch on it to make sure that this is included in what people are thinking about when they're talking about a land revitalization project. There are several programs that have to do with using green approaches in construction and site development. We have Energy Star. There's the Green Building Program. There's EPA's Greenscapes, which has to do with landscaping, with an eye towards providing environmental services like stormwater, runoff control, and other services. You can incorporate the natural systems to manage stormwater, such as green roofs, landscaped swales, and wetlands. Smart growth principles is something that has been a very strong focus for EPA, and for larger projects especially, working to design a project where you do have some of those principles included, such as walkable neighborhoods and open space, access to public transportation is very good. Creating ecological enhancements to provide biological diversities, and again, in this phase, as in all others, using clean fuels and using renewable energy resources where possible. The last phase of a land revitalization project would be the actual follow-on use and the sustainable stewardship of that use, the stewardship. So with a follow-on use, again, we have the standard emphasis on reducing the creation of toxic materials and the use of toxic materials in manufacturing, reducing and minimizing the amount of hazardous waste and non-hazardous waste that are generated, maintaining engineering and institutional controls at a site where there may be waste left in place, and that is something that we have an emphasis on in the sense of our remedies are only as strong as we continue to maintain them as they are needed. Reducing water use, reducing other resource use, and maximizing energy efficiency and increasing the use of renewable energies are all approaches that can be taken in the last phase of a land revitalization project. Moving on to slide 11, I just put some pictures here of some activities that have been done. The green remediation webpage, which Carlos will talk about more about today, has several several case studies or approaches that have been posted. Some of them I've put here. And I will just start on the upper left-hand corner with Altus Air Force Base, where you see that a solar power solar panel is powering a small submersible pump for their pump and treat system. If you were to move over to the right to the GM Duke Baltimore, what you'll see is this was an exciting project. It's a RCRA project, and it was notable in the sense of they were able to deconstruct 3.5 million square feet of buildings, with 96% of that building material recycled. They also recycled other materials, including 98,000 tons of other materials. So that's a good example of really focusing on the demolition phase and seeing what you can do to minimize your waste. Moving on to the right to Kenosha Harbor Park, this was a RCRA site that was redeveloped in Wisconsin. What was notable about this is they really tried to apply smart growth principles. So what you'll see is that there's housing mixed in with a park and open space. There's easy access to public transportation, and you can take public transportation straight downtown into Chicago. It's linked to area bike trails. It's linked to the water, so boats can even come up to it. So there's a lot that has been done to try to make that a very livable community and to reduce the resources that are necessary to live there. Moving on down to the bottom left-hand corner to the Ford Rouge plant, this was one of the earlier sustainable approaches that was used in land revitalization. But they did a tremendous job. They had it at the point when it was built, I believe, the largest green roof. They set up the building so that all workers got natural light. There was extensive stormwater runoff ecological restoration and habitat creation. You'll see a lot of sunflowers there. That was for migratory birds. Moving on to the middle, to Roma, Palo Alto, California. This is an interesting project that is underway right now, and they're looking at using enhanced biological treatment as a supplement to pump and treat, so that instead of just using pump and treat, they're relying much more heavily on the biological treatment. And what they're finding is that they expect to have very good results, as good or better than the pump and treat, and have it done in a much shorter amount of time. What's exciting about this project as well is that they're making an effort to analyze what the differences in footprint, their carbon footprint, would be from looking at the different approaches. And this is a project to follow because I think it will be interesting to see how this analysis is done and to see what the results are. Moving to the right, you'll see Bethlehem Steel. And I just threw that in. We all know that Bethlehem has had a lot of steel sites that have closed. In Lackawanna, there is a project to site large industrial or large commercial windmills on that site. This is a picture with the first date that were sited, and many more are planned. They'll be providing a lot of power to the city, and it's a really interesting reuse of a hazardous waste site. And Penelope is going to talk more about reusing hazardous waste sites for renewable energy today. So moving on to page 12, just real quickly, what I tried to do is throw a lot of our resources here so you can find them in one place. We have the sustainability webpage. We have our general Office of Brownfields webpage, which has extensive amount of information on land revitalization. And they're also doing some innovative pilots on green approaches with the brownfield projects. We have the RCRA Reuse Brownfields Initiative listed. We have the RCRA Resource Conservation Challenge Program, which deals more with the recycling and waste minimization. We have the Superfund Redevelopment Program listed here, and the Environmentally Responsible Redevelopment Reuse Program, which is a program to encourage sites to use green approaches in their land reuse projects, and that's from our enforcement office. We've got the CLUIN website listed here and an ecological restoration website listed here, both of which have tremendous amount of resources on them. Our Brownfields and Land Revitalization Technology Support Center. We have an industrial materials recycling website, which is fabulous for learning more about using industrial materials in construction projects, as well as where you would find those materials. And we have our EPA's Smart Growth Program. I just want to highlight briefly that this is a very exciting field in that it seems every week we learn of new projects or new innovative approaches that are being done. And we're making a strong effort here at EPA to try to get that information organized and passed back out to people as soon as possible. This webinar is one of our ways that we reach out to people. And I just want to note that there's a series of webinars that are being done on sustainability. One was held last week. I believe the next one is on December 16th, and the last one is in January. So please check back with CLUIN and look at the types of seminars that are going on. Again, a really great thing about CLUIN is that all these seminars are recorded and archived. So if you miss a seminar, you can call it up on your own convenience. You can get into a room with several people and watch it together or go through it together. So it's a living resource for you all. Moving on to page 13 and 14, I just have put there a little one-pager that we developed, so you can have that if you'd like it. And at this point, I am done, so I'm going to turn the mic over to Carlo, or to Penelope.
The folks on the line, Carlos, if you can hear me okay, just let me know. I'm on my cell phone, so there's some poor reception. Okay, so starting with slide 14, I believe. No, 15. I'm going to, as Sarah just mentioned, I'm going to go over the potential kind of at the reuse end of things when you are dealing with a cleanup site, hazardous waste site, Superfund RCRA, brownfields, any kind of site, what are renewable energy development as a potential redevelopment option? And I'm going to go over a little bit, just a real quick overview of the history of the development of this initiative. And very quickly, why it's important and why we are pursuing this. Just some facts and figures, a little bit on a tool that we've developed to help facilitate the information exchange related to our sites and renewable energy development potential, and some of the incentives that are available, and then quick run through on some of the success stories, and then some contact info. So to start off with, we have, going on to the next slide, the initiative is called Repowering America's Land, Siting Renewable Energy on Contaminated Lands and Mining Sites. We launched this initially back in 2008 in May at the Brownfields Conference, where we hosted a renewable energy panel of experts and had a fairly good turnout of folks that were interested in this subject, and we got a lot of very positive feedback and interest for further information on what was actually available at EPA sites and what was the potential there. So we had participation from industry, state and federal government. We had folks from the environmental and energy departments at the state level, as well as the Department of Energy at federal level, some venture capital participants, as well as the renewable energy developers themselves, and the actual contaminated land owners. We had a couple participants from that sector as well. And the idea was to really kind of bring this idea out into the open, kind of launch this idea, and get some real good public support about it and find it. What were the barriers, what are some of the opportunities, and kind of what should be our next steps. And our administrator, Steve Johnson, announced this in September of 2008, a couple months ago, at the Environmental Council of States conference, some of you may have been at. So that kind of officially launched it. That's a quick run through of the history. We started looking at this as a potential redevelopment option because we have, well, first of all, there are many, many, many thousands of sites that EPA tracks that include actually millions of acres of land. And I'll get to some more of the specific numbers in a few slides. Many of these sites we find are situated in areas that are kind of rural, non-urban areas, as many of us know, renewable energy development, wind farms particularly, but even solar farms can be met with kind of aesthetic opposition, and many of our sites are actually kind of in rural areas where it may be less likely to come up against those issues. Some of the what we're calling siting amenities include, and this is very important and gets to kind of what Sarah was talking about with, you know, reusing existing infrastructure that's on site. Many of these sites already are wired, if you will. They have existing electric transmission lines that are available on site. They have electricity capacity. They also have access, roads and railways, and many of them are adequately zoned for this type of reuse. So the rezoning process that might need to be gone through, if it were, say, to be redeveloped as a residential, for example, or some other reuse, doesn't need to happen with a renewable energy facility for many of these sites. And again, just getting to the cost, this avoids, the costs associated with new infrastructure, that capital cost that can be quite high, Of course, the rezoning costs as well. And I'm sorry, I skipped a couple of slides. I am now on slide 18, I believe. Okay. Just, you know, again, why redevelop renewable energy facilities on EPA track sites? Many of them will have lower overall transaction costs compared to greenfields, so compared to redeveloping a pristine area of land that doesn't have any infrastructure available. So there are potential cost savings there. And on that same point about greenfields, it does reduce the stress that can be put on greenfield lands, undeveloped pristine lands, for developing renewable energy or energy facilities. And that's kind of part of why we're looking at these already used pieces of land as an ideal place to locate renewable energy facilities, you know, production, transmission lines, whatever they may be, to site those infrastructure on these properties. So we're avoiding going into the greenfields area, which is a getting some interference. A very important part of the natural carbon sequestration. So undisturbed lands, pristine lands are important for that, and we're trying to encourage moving away from that and really reusing sites that have already been disturbed. And of course, these types of facilities would provide clean energy, emission-free energy, and for use either on-site for application immediately on-site or locally very nearby or to be put into the overall utility grid. All right, slide 19. Okay, so just getting to some of the numbers, we track over 16 million acres of land that's potentially contaminated. That's about 480,000 sites across the United States. And I had mentioned this a short while ago, that there are many of the sites are in what we're calling urban or rural or non-urban areas, and approximately 80% of the sites that we track, or 13-plus million acres, fall within this category. So the majority of the sites fall into this category. 20% of the overall sites are actually abandoned mine lands, which is important because we find that many of the abandoned mine sites are quite large, and so there's and that's very important for siting renewables because you need a lot of land. But also, many of these mine sites are well wired. They have many of the amenities that would be necessary for siting renewables. And just another where we have cleaned up or put controls in place at more than 850,000 acres of these sites. So there is a significant number of sites that are what we term like ready for reuse. That's not to say that other sites cannot be used, but these are the sites that are kind of ready for reuse, controls in place, and if they're not being currently used, they would be, you know, ready to go or more likely to be able to host renewable energy or some kind of redevelopment. And as we're seeing now with our ailing economy and the goals that have been laid out by the incoming administration for growing, you know, green jobs and a green economy, this type of redevelopment we see is, you know, providing job opportunities. And again, in many of these sites, like, you know, the steel sites and the mining sites, where they actually provided many jobs in the past when they closed up shop, all the jobs went with them. So we kind of see this as an opportunity to reintroduce some of those local job opportunities, to develop, to operate, to maintain, the equipment that's, the equipment and the facilities, for these renewable energy facilities. And slide 20. Again, just some of the numbers. The kind of total technical potential that we have calculated for, and I'm getting into the solar and wind renewable energies, the total technical potential if we developed, and this is a big if, and highly unlikely, but this is just to demonstrate the total potential for solar energy generation capacity. If we developed all of those EPA track lands with solar energy, we would get over 2 million megawatts of energy out of that. And just to put that in perspective, the Energy Information Administration, the branch of the Department of Energy that tracks all of the energy demands and growth, growth in population and what that will equate to in energy consumption in the future, projects that for photovoltaics and thermal, thermal solar capacity will be at about 6,100 megawatts in 2010, so in a couple of years. So the reason why I put that in there is because it just goes to show that there is a lot of land that could meet just what they're predicting to be the capacity in 2010, and it may be more than that, maybe less, hopefully more, and into the future. So there is, the point is that there is a lot of land that's available to develop renewable energies on to meet the demand for growing demand for solar. And likewise, the next couple of bullets are about wind, 120,000 megawatts if we developed with wind energy, and that far exceeds the projected capacity in 2010. Okay, the next slide. Okay. So just moving on to some of the tools, and this one in particular is a Google Earth mapping tool that we've developed to really help facilitate getting the information out to all of the interested parties, whether they be the states, whether they be private developers, venture capital, real estate people, whoever, the contaminated property owners, whoever they may be, to get this information out to them so they can really take a good look at what is possible at their site or within a state or within a region. So we developed this Google Earth mapping tool where we brought together all of EPA's, all EPA tract sites that I had mentioned earlier. We screened them against criteria that is necessary for siting renewable energy, primarily the renewable energy resource potential in the area, so there's lots of sun, we screened against that, wind. We also looked at distance to roads, distance to rail, acreage of the site, as well as the existence of transmission capacity and lines to and from the site. So using that screening criteria, we whittled down the sites, if you will, to about 10,000, which is quite a difference between the 480,000 that we track. So there are about 10,000 sites that are in this Google Earth mapping tool, and they all have some form of renewable energy generation potential. And just a caveat, this doesn't mean that every site in the database is ready to go for development. But the idea for providing this tool is to show at every site that qualifies, based on the screening criteria, what is the potential at the site if it were to be reused. So the idea is just to get kind of the broadest cast of net and get as many sites in as possible, and then have the folks who are interested in redeveloping take a closer look at the sites. To see, you know, what kind of structures are already there, you know, if there are other kinds of site-specific issues that may play a part in redevelopment with renewables. So I just jumped ahead a little bit, but so the idea was to kind of bring these sites together with the renewable energy generation potential and map them out. So we put these up on this Google Earth. It's an interactive mapping tool. Where you can click on any of the sites, and you can get a variety of information. I'll go over that in just a second. We produced over 170 state-specific maps showing renewable energy development potential on EPA tract sites. So virtually every state has a number of sites that qualify for renewable energy development. And keep in mind, these are just the EPA tract sites. These do not include state sites. We also produced basically financial incentive fact sheets that describe the renewable energy development incentives for each state. Also, on the kind of backside, it's kind of a joint fact sheet. On the backside of that fact sheet, you'll find for every state contaminated land redevelopment incentives. So to bring those two sets of incentives together, we thought was important because they complement each other when it comes to redevelopment. The next slide, I think we're on 22 now. Okay. I pretty much touched on most of these folks. This is just a general kind of overview. Who is the audience here? And it's really anybody that's interested in developing renewable energy on contaminated properties. Well, renewable energy in general and on contaminated properties in particular. So the developers, state, federal, private, environmental managers, consultants, you name it. And we've received a lot of inquiries from each of these different stakeholders. So it looks like the tool is being used, which is very, very good. And we hope more people will use it through venues, hearing about it through venues like this. So going on to the next slide, slide 23, is just a screenshot of the website where you can find the Google Earth tool, as well as tools and guidance for developing sites, mining sites, as well as liability relief information, as that has been an issue with any kind of redevelopment on a EPA track site or a contaminated or perceived contaminated site. Liability issues always come up, so we included some very, very useful information on liability relief. So looking at this screenshot, and I provide the website at the end of the presentation, so don't squint too hard to see that in the address line. But if you look down where it says Renewable Energy Interactive Maps, you just click on that. It's a KMZ file. It's a typical kind of Google Earth formatted file. Click on that, and you will have to have Google Earth loaded onto your computer first. You can do that in the instructions below first if you don't already have it. You click on the KMZ file and it launches and you're ready to go, and you can scroll through and click on any of the sites and find out all the information on the site. The next slide just shows, I'm going to skip through that one, it's just a screenshot of the whole country with all of the sites dotted out. And we categorize based on the type of site, so you can see if it's an abandoned mine site or a RCRA site or brownfields or a superfund or a non-federal superfund. So not a federal facility. The next slide is a screenshot of I just picked a site at random. This is the Anaconda Minerals company in Great Falls, Montana. And this is what you'll get when you click on a site. You will get you'll get the site name, as well as the EPID. And you'll see some highlighted hyperlinks in here. And the first one is the current environmental status of the site. If you click on that, that will take you to the EPA maintained page for that site. So it will tell you everything about it and what's going on environmentally at that site, what's EPA's involvement, where is it in the cleanup process, has it been cleaned up at all, is it done. So you can find out all of that information, as well as contact information for the site. So EPA project managers, and for RCRA sites, you can find actually the site. Oftentimes you'll find the site owner contact information. So all of that information is publicly available. We're just bringing it to one spot for ease of use. So if you go down a little bit further on this pop-up window, you'll find the wind, all the renewable energy generation potential, and it's presented qualitatively and quantitatively. So it looks like at this site, the wind resource potential is outstanding in a qualitative term. The utility solar potential is good, and then, of course, non-grid. And just a note, everything qualifies for non-grid because anything can host a solar panel without connecting to the grid. And if you scroll down just a little bit further, we also have some information on biomass. It looks like it's, for this site, it's actually outstanding. And you scroll down a little bit further on this, you'll see site-specific renewable energy data. And that we find we get a ton of requests for. It's the actual raw data that we use. It's in an Excel spreadsheet format. It's the raw data that we use to create these maps. And so it can be uploaded into any GIS system. We're working on creating some shape files right now, and those will be loaded in probably a few weeks, so a little bit easier to use. But this is that's the foundation data for creating these maps. And the data and methodology description, that's the data guidelines. It basically gives you just that. It's the methodology for how we created this, and then the data limitations. And then you can find static maps for this. So for this site in particular, you would click on that U.S. and state maps and incentive sheets. You would go to Montana, and you would find like PDF and JPEGs of each of the state maps for Montana. But they're in static; they're not interactive. Just JPEGs and PDFs for your use, upload, and use in presentations or what have you. Okay, so the next site. Okay, my computer doesn't seem to be working. Okay, the next slide is just a quick overview of the incentives. We included all of the state incentives that we could find for every state, and that included things like grants and loans and whether net metering is available or not, who the contacts are for every program, for every incentive program, so it's readily accessible. The contact name and number and email are on these sheets. We, of course, included federal incentives as well. We're updating right now to include the latest, which is in that table, the latest renewable energy incentives. Most of them have just been extended through the Economic Recovery Act that just went through in October. So you can take a look at that and what the credit amounts are and what the deadline, the in-service deadlines are when they expire. And you can always find, we work hard to keep these up to speed, but clearly, as we've seen in just the past couple of months, things can change very quickly with respect to incentives. So a very, very good place to go to get up to the date, up to the minute information on incentives is the database for state incentives for renewable energy, and that is DSIRE USA.org. It's a great, great resource. I encourage you to check that out for your state, incentives in your state as they change. The next slide is just a quick screenshot of what our incentive sheets look like. When you click on that state maps and incentive sheets link, you will find all of the incentive sheets for every state, and this is basically what they look like. And I won't go into detail, any more details on that. Then quickly just get into some of the success stories. You just heard about, from Sarah, the Bethlehem Steel site in Lackawanna. As she had mentioned, they erected a former steel site. They erected 8 wind turbines with a generation capacity of 20 megawatts, approximately enough to power approximately 7,000 homes. They're currently working on expanding to 18 wind turbines to add 10 more wind turbines by 2010 to a total capacity of 45 megawatts. The wind turbines are domestically manufactured in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, so great for local and domestic jobs. This site was basically led by a private developer that came in and brokered the whole deal. They came in, they worked with the federal EPA, with the state EPA, to make sure that, you know, they were everything was good environmentally. They weren't doing anything that might disturb any existing contamination. went very smoothly. They were able to get financing fairly readily, and they were up and running pretty quickly. So it's a fantastic success story and a great, great reuse of a site that otherwise is just sitting there fenced off and not really being used. So also a great tax base for the local city as well. The next one is Slide 30. This is a Fort Carson, Colorado. They installed a 2-megawatt solar panel array, solar field. And this is on a former 12-acre landfill. So you can see how large this is in the photo. Imagine that with nothing on it. Now it's actually producing something and being useful. It produces approximately 3,200 megawatt hours of electricity every year. They locked in a really good rate of 5.5 cents per kilowatt hour for the duration of the 17-year contract that they have with the utility. I think it's with the utility. Their expected savings, kind of rough calculation of the expected savings is approximately $500,000 in electricity during the life of the 17-year contract. So it's pretty significant. Again, a fantastic reuse for a site that otherwise would not be used. And the next slide, slide 31, is this is really more of a on-site use, so local, very, very local on-site use of renewable energy. This is a micro hydroelectric plant that's, I think it's still being installed. This is a fairly recent photo at the Summitville Mines, Colorado. They're working to treat the on-site acid mine drainage, and they're doing that, providing the energy to do that by installing this micro hydroelectric plant. So it's basically they are going to be able to provide 100% of the energy that's necessary to run the treatment of the acid drainage effluent. So they don't have to pull from the grid, which is fantastic. So basically a zero net energy operation for the most part. And then I think this is the last one. I have, this is a fairly recent development as well. This is the Holmes Road Landfill. It's a solar field, proposed solar field in Houston, Texas. This was a former 300-acre landfill. It's near downtown. They want to build this solar field, and EPA helped with the assessment of the project by granting a $50K grant through our Brownfields program to help look at the energy generation potential and some of the kind of environmental and some of the engineering and some of the regulatory issues involved in the project to help facilitate that project forward. I don't have a status update on when that might be completed, but hopefully I will by the next time I give this presentation. And I think that's about it. Slide 33 just has the website that I referred to earlier. It's epa.gov/renewableenergyland. You can find all of that information, the Google Earth tool, the liability relief, as well as some of the policy and guidance on redevelopment. For any specific questions, you can email cleanenergy@epa.gov, and you can also call me. It's the next slide. And that's about it. Thank you. And Carlos.
Do you want to keep it in right now? Yeah, this is Mike, and Carlos is going to get started in a second here. And just to address one issue, I know that we're having some audio problems, and we're working on those. But we'd like to open up for those on the phone lines, Q&A, if you have any questions right now. Remember to unmute your phone. And we do have one that – I do have a question to get us started here. I think this is for Penelope. If about 80% of the sites are non-urban in location, how does siting renewable energy production at these removed locations help offset the energy demands of people likely to be located – at some distance removed from the site? Doesn't renewable energy production need to occur closer to the energy need?
That's a great question. There, it Okay, so there are a couple things. You can use any energy, renewable energy, energy from coal, close to the site, but you can also put that into the grid and have that go out into the grid to be used. Yes, I think ideally, because there are efficiency, losses in efficiency, losses in actual energy as you transport that in lines, in the actual transmission lines, I think, yes, it is ideal to have that reuse very close. But when we say remote, I mean, there are still communities close enough by that can receive this via transmission lines through the utility. So I think again, this is, you know, very site specific issue. If it's close by, that's ideal, but it can be put into the transmission infrastructure and transported for use further away from the site.
Okay, thanks. Are there any questions from the phone lines? Remember to unmute, you need to hit #6.
Hello?
Yes.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Has EPA implemented any renewable energy type projects at any fund lead Superfund site?
Very good question. We have, and I know there are more than just this one that I'm going to give you as an example. There's a fund lead in Southern California and Maywood. It's the Pemeco Superfund site, where they installed solar panels to help augment the energy required for the remediation of the site. That was a fund lead site. Trying to think of other ones. I can look further into that. I should have that down, but I don't, unfortunately. But I can look further into that and somehow get that information back out, and I'm not sure how I would do that. But
I have a follow-up. Have there been any PRP-led Superfund sites that have implemented any kind of renewable energy on site?
There are probably more of those than the ones that are fund lead, just because of the sheer number. We had a site, there are a couple. There's the Apache Powder site, where they also installed solar to help augment power. There is the Lawrence Livermore site 300, I believe. I don't think it was the main site, but the Lawrence Livermore site, they installed solar panels to help provide energy for the treatment system. Frontier Fertilizer is another one. I believe that was out in Davis, California, I believe. Again, they installed a solar array to help power the treatment system. That's PRP-led. It's a large site in Southern California. It's the Operating Industries OII site. You may be familiar with. This isn't solar or wind per se, but they did harness the landfill gas to burn that and run some microturbines to provide about 80% of the energy needed on site. So those are some of that are coming to me off the top of my head. There are others, but that's a sampling.
We had a question for Penelope. On the Fort Carson, Colorado site, what was the return on investment, actually, of the solar panels in comparison to the cost?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. The only information that I have, it's a good question, though. I'll check into it. The only information I have was on the rate that they got fixed in their contract with the utility at 5.5 cents, and then the overall savings in energy throughout the life of the contract. I can check it.
Okay. Are there any others from the phone? If not, I've got a few more here. What was the screening criteria for eliminating EPA track sites from consideration for renewable energy, or if there was any?
Well, there was. It was basically what would screen in, and then everything else by default would screen out. All of this information is actually available on the website, the renewable energy website that I mentioned at the end. So you can read very specifically what the screening criteria are for every renewable energy. So for solar, we looked at for all the different types of renewable energy, so whether it be solar, wind, or the biomass, we looked at acreage of the site because that's important for all of these. We looked at the transmission capacity, transmission lines, access. But for each of the different types of renewable energies, we looked at kind of what was, say for biomass, what was the total amount of biomass available within a 50-mile radius. So that's one screening criteria, but that's specific for biomass. And any of the sites that didn't meet that screening criteria were screened out. So similarly for solar, and there are various kind of grades of solar. So there's non-grid, which is not grid connected, so very small scale non-grid connected systems. There are community scale, which are a little bit smaller. They're a little bit larger than non-grid. And then there's the utility scale, which is commercial grade solar production. So each of those has a solar resource capacity cutoff, if you will, and you can read each one of those. There, it would take me a while to go through that on the phone. But and the same for wind. It's the same screening criteria, the same type of screening criteria for wind. So what was the wind energy generation potential that would qualify for utility, community, and non-grid, respectively. So find that on that website.
Okay, thanks for answering those questions. I think we're going to go ahead and move on for the sake of time to Carlos with his presentation.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks, Penny. And hello, everybody. This is Carlos Pachon. I'm starting on slide 35. A couple of thoughts I had. I wanted to mention that the title of this seminar is Green Remediation Update, U.S. EPA, Illinois EPA Green Remediation Update. The reason of this title is that we are covering or revisiting a lot of the material that was delivered on Earth Day back in April of this year. And we received a request from Illinois EPA, and I'd like to recognize Heather Nifong for her initiative in getting us going and scheduling this seminar and getting the speakers back together and updating the material that we delivered on Earth Day. So thanks a lot to Heather and at SWAMO for collaborating on this effort. There is a difference with respect to what was presented on Earth Day. One of the topics presented on that seminar was the concept of carbon sequestration and abandoned mine land recovery remediation projects. That topic is not going to be presented today. However, it's substituted by one that's got a lot of inertia, which is the speaker that's coming after me, and that is the development of the voluntary standards for site cleanups. So Deb Goldman will be covering that one after my presentation. So that's just a little bit of background. And then as far as the turnout, again, we've got a great turnout. We've got 260 folks on the line covering practically all states from Alabama to Wisconsin. So thanks for your interest and thanks for participating. So far we've had two presentations. Sarah Rasmussen has given us this big picture of sustainability and site cleanup and redevelopment. Penny McDaniel has gotten into some of the detail of where we are on placing renewable energy on potentially or contaminated lands. And now I'm going to focus on sustainability and site cleanup. So the title of my talk is Green Remediation evolving best management practices. So with that intro, I'll go ahead to my second slide, slide 36, which is titled, What is Green Remediation? And we have a short paragraph up here, and the way we're currently describing it is the practice of considering all environmental effects of a cleanup during each phase of the process and incorporating strategies to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup. Now, at the bottom of that slide, there's a, in italicized, there's a, almost call it a caveat that says that the focus is currently on remedy implementation versus remedy selection. Admittedly, that remedy is a very Superfund focused term, but it definitely applies to all cleanup programs. Why do we say that? There are two reasons why we're focusing on implementation. The first is that the concept of green cleanups is, it's not to compare one remedy to another. It's not to compare thermal, ex situ or in situ thermal to M&A and see which one has the lowest environmental footprint. The concept here is about any remedy or any cleanup approach that we're going to put in place, what can we do to reduce its environmental footprint? So in a sense, it's thermal versus thermal and M&A versus M&A. One of the analogies I like to use is, phytoremediation, for example. Phytoremediation, we think, we're using plants to clean up a site. Well, phyto, in and of itself, is not necessarily a green remedy. If we compare one phyto project to another, we can have a phytoremediation project where they are using excessive fertilizers, so we're contaminating surface water through nutrient loading. They're using and maybe an invasive species in an extreme case versus a native species of plant. The soil is being tilled and left unprotected, so we have the soil erosion. In other words, we're using excessive pesticides to keep the plants healthy. So you can imagine just comparing one phyto project to another. You can have a green phyto project, and you can have a non-green phyto project. That's the main reason why we're focusing on remedy implementation, because we want to identify the best practices of putting any cleanup remedy or approach in place, not comparing one remedy to another. That, in addition, the second reason, particularly more structured cleanup programs such as Superfund, that gets us into a discussion, almost a policy and philosophical discussion of, is M&A better than in-situ thermal? And we don't have the tools, the quantitative tools, yet to fully understand that, but that should not stop us from adopting green remediation practices in putting a remedy in place. So that's a little bit, a summary of why we have that italicized note down there, that the focus of green remediation is currently pretty much on implementation, remedy cleanup implementation versus selection. If we could go to slide 37, this recaps what Sarah presented earlier, but I'm going to go into it in a little bit more detail, into each of these six core elements. So as I've mentioned earlier, in EPA, we see the concept of green cleanups as one that applies to all cleanup programs. This is not Superfund specific. This is not, it's not RCRA corrective action or underground storage tank or brownfields or state voluntary cleanup programs. The concept applies to all cleanup programs. And it overlays existing regulatory frameworks. It's not something new. Of course, for each of those programs, there are different caveats, but it's a concept. These are best practices that overlay current existing regulatory frameworks. There's no reason to revisit our regulations because we're finding that these best practices fit into the regulatory frameworks for all cleanup programs. And exist throughout the site investigation, design, construction, operation, and monitoring. However, the focus is, if you recall that slide that we saw earlier that Sarah presented, everything from preparing the site for cleanup, clean it up, reconstruction, and reuse, the focus is on that cleanup phase. So that's what we'll be talking about the next 10 to 15 minutes. So if we could go to the next slide, slide number 4. I'm going to start discussing of those core elements, energy, air, water, land and ecosystems, material and waste, long-term stewardship, I'm going to discuss each one of these in some detail. And on this first slide, core energy requirements, of course, given the where we are with you know, the discussion and the reality of climate change, and also a bit of a legacy of earlier this year when oil prices were at $150 a barrel, a lot of focus in green remediation is falling on energy and the climate change implications. So let's talk about those a little bit. That first slide, I've actually moved on from that first bullet. I actually significantly changed it, and that discussion around that point, because that's a little bit of a legacy from early on when we were comparing or talking about selecting one remedy versus another. But still, the concept of optimized passive energy technologies with little or no demand for external utility power is one that applies in combination with more active energy or energy-intensive approaches and cleaning at the site. But let me move on to that second bullet, which is one of the key concepts of energy, of the best practices when it comes to energy requirements for cleaning up a site, and that is the use of energy-efficient equipment operating at peak performance, coupled with the third bullet, the periodic evaluation and optimization of equipment with high energy demand. And I'll talk about high energy demand technologies a little bit later, but the idea here is that we have found, certainly in EPA, that a lot of the remedy decisions that were made and implementation and project implementations that were done historically when energy was at $10 a barrel, we were finding that there are many opportunities to optimize how those systems are operated, particularly pump and treat systems, as well as looking at the equipment that we're using and finding that lots of these systems were put in place 10, 15 years ago. And the private sector has evolved. There's new, much more efficient technologies to operate these systems, as well as much more efficient means of implementation. We look at remedial system evaluations. We're doing quite a few of those in EPA, as well as long-term monitoring optimization, and finding that there are tremendous energy savings to be had in those. And then the fourth bullet that I have is renewable energy systems to replace or offset grid electricity to power those technologies that we do decide to put in place. Penny talked a lot about the concept of and where we are in identifying opportunities to place renewable energy on contaminated sites, regardless of whether or not there's a there's an operating remedy on the site. Here, it's that same concept, but extended to use that energy to power remedies. The Green Remediation website, and this in part answers one of the questions that last questions that Penn received, including.org/greenremediation, and I'll give you the URL. It's the last slide, so don't worry about writing it down. But we have about 20 profiles of green remediation best practices. Several of those do focus on the use of renewable energy to power remedies, and several of those are at on-fund lead sites and PRP lead sites, that is, national priority list sites, although not all of them are on Superfund sites. But definitely that's where we see an opportunity. And indeed, next week there is going to be a Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable meeting here in D.C. If you go to frtr.gov, you can get information about participating. That whole meeting is going to be webcast. And a lot of the services, Department, the Army, Air Force, Navy, as well as NASA, Department of Energy, will be joining EPA and talking about where they are in green remediation. And a lot of the discussion, admittedly, is going to be on the topic of renewable energy. So for those of you that have an interest, specific interest in the energy component, I invite you to join us at the FRTR meeting next week. Again, you can get registration information. It's open to the public at frtr.gov. So with that, I'll go to the next slide, slide number five. Slide number 39 on the Internet seminar. Another of the core elements is air emissions. So what is it about putting a construction project in site that has impact on air quality, usually in the area immediate to the site, and what can we do about reducing those environmental impacts. So I have four examples up here, and lots of these are really borrowed from other sectors. So in developing these concepts of green mitigation best practices, we've looked at other sectors and adopted and brought in and hope to advance those best practices in contaminated site cleanups. So one of them is the optimal use and proper maintenance of heavy equipment, which often called in construction sector yellow iron. So what is it about these large, usually diesel-powered pieces of equipment that we have on a site that can be done to reduce their emissions? So certainly proper maintenance is one of them. Just like a car, many states have emissions controls. Well, the same applies to this equipment. And if we see a construction site, especially in the early stages, often we'll see 5, 6, 7 pieces of heavy equipment operating at once, and those can have a negative impact, detrimental impact on local air quality in an area that may already be having issues with that, often because we are in urban areas. So an optimal use and proper maintenance of yellow iron is one of those best practices when it comes to reducing impacts on air quality in a contaminated site cleanup project. A second is the use of cleaner, and related to the first one, of cleaner fuel or retrofit diesel engines for that heavy equipment. Some states have mandatory requirements when it comes to the use of low-sulfur diesel. I don't know where it is on a national level right now, but on a voluntary basis, there are opportunities, I think, almost in every state to use low-sulfur diesel and to retrofit diesel equipment to reduce emissions of SOx, NOx, and particularly particulate matter, 2.5 and 10 micrometers. Another best practice when it comes to air emissions is modifying operations to reduce operating and idle time. A lot of the big consulting engineering firms and construction firms already incorporate these best practices in their operations. The concept is, you know, simple one, if a piece of equipment is not going to be used for a certain period of time, instead of leaving the engine idling, either keep the cab warm, not have to start it up again, shut that equipment down. This applies to both large equipment as well as auxiliary power units. If you look at a construction site, often you'll see multiple auxiliary power units around the vicinity of the site, and they are best management practices when it comes to idling time and operating of this equipment that can be adopted at a contaminated site cleanup. And then the final bullet I have up there is minimizing dust export of contaminants. Again, we see this especially in dry months, in areas where there's a lot of truck traffic, the practice of watering down roads and other best practices to reduce the dust export of contaminants and export of dust per se. Just the dust is also, dust can also be have a detrimental effect on air quality in the area around the project of the site that is being cleaned up. So let's move on to slide number 40. Another of the core elements of green remediation. Best practices are the concepts associated with, or practices associated with, water requirements and water resources. So some examples that we have four bullets here. One is minimizing freshwater use and maximizing the reuse of water during the treatment and site operations. There are many on-site treatment systems that require freshwater use, and there are many opportunities to develop reuse of that water. One of these is, for example, relates to equipment that's been developed for trucks that drive off-site. There's equipment now that will wash the tires of the trucks to eliminate, for example, in rainy periods, all the mud that's stuck onto the tires, so that when the truck leaves the site, it does not carry that mud onto the site. Well, there are systems that will wash down, hose down the tires, eliminate all that mud, all that soil that not only carries nutrients and turbidity and sediment to surface water bodies off-site, but also may carry contaminants. And there's a capture area that water is filtered and reused again to wash the tires. So that's just one example of minimizing fresh water use and maximizing reuse during our treatment and site operations. Another opportunity is reclaim treated water for beneficial reuse or aquifer storage. EPA actually put out, I think it was about 2 years ago, an analysis of a policy analysis and technical analysis of opportunities to reuse pump and treat of groundwater. So instead of discharging it to PLTWs, there are opportunities to use it for aquifer recharge and other beneficial reuses. So that's another area that another best practice that we're trying to foster and raise awareness and about opportunities of how that can be done. Another option is native vegetation requiring little or no irrigation. Sarah mentioned this a little bit. It includes retaining native vegetation and when and where necessary, reseeding or replanting with native vegetation to reduce the requirements for irrigation as that site moves on towards restoration. And then I mentioned this several times on this slide, the basic concept of surface water, off-site surface water quality, and reducing impacts to streams and other surface water bodies from nutrient loading, turbidity, sediment runoff, et cetera, from site operations. We can move on to slide number 7. 41. This is the fourth of the core elements. That's the land and ecosystems. So a couple of examples of what we refer to here when it comes to reducing impacts on land and ecosystems. The first one I have up there is the idea of planning to minimize soil and habitat disturbance and recycle topsoil where possible. You know, topsoil plays an important function in the ecosystems in general, and operating equipment on a site, an extensive site, can result in soil compaction. If we can avoid that soil compaction, we'll increase infiltration during the cleanup phase of the site, and post-cleanup we'll avoid having to come back and till that soil to make sure that it recovers its physical properties that that facilitate plant establishment and ecosystem recovery. And then same with topsoil. If we can remove the topsoil and keep it on site for reuse in recovering that site, we'll avoid having to truck fresh topsoil in from off-site. The concept of identifying sensitive and endangered species. I think that bullet, I need to change that. I don't mean to say clear the site of sensitive and endangered species. In fact, what we want to do is prevent or minimize the impact that we have on sensitive or endangered species that are at the site or in the vicinity of the site. Ideas such as understanding what species are in the habitat immediate to the site and whether or not, for example, they're in a particular sensitive phase of their life cycle, be it reproductive, rearing chicks, in case of birds, et cetera, is there something that we can do about how we phase our site operations or how we implement them to reduce the negative impacts on those species, such as reducing lighting at night, noise, and other impacts that we might have on those species. Another example is pursuing revegetation with native species. We mentioned that earlier, but it's not only the water requirements that they may have, but also ensuring that the plants and the ecosystem that we reestablish links up with existing local habitats, the whole concept of eco-restoration. And again, Sarah pointed out to some to an eco-restoration website we have, but it's integrating the habitat on the site with existing habitat corridors, et cetera, so that in long term, there's more of a link up between our site that we're cleaning up and local. And finally, I think I mentioned that it's reduced light, noise and lighting disturbance, regardless of whether or not there are sensitive species on site. What is it that we can do to reduce impacts on humans, on people in the vicinity of the site, as well as ecosystem? So we'll move on to slide number 8. And I'll be brief on this one because Sarah did cover it in some more detail, but basically it's the concept of material consumption and waste generation and recycling at the site as one of the core elements of green cleanups. So the first is technologies designed to minimize waste generation and resource use. Reusing and recycling of materials, including construction and demolition debris, at any large construction site nowadays. We have one outside our window here in Crystal City where they're putting up a new building, and they're segregating steel from the old building. They're segregating the concrete so it'll be crushed to as a resource for other projects. So the whole concept of recovering construction material from the site, it's very advanced in a lot of construction sectors, but it's not always fully implemented in site cleanup. Of course, there are some issues associated with ensuring that the debris is clean enough for reuse, but again, those best practices have also been developed. It's a matter of fostering awareness and adoption of those best practices at site cleanup projects. So if we could go to slide number
43.
Long-term stewardship, what is it about long-term stewardship? Quite often there are decisions that are made in designing and implementing a remedy that have impacts on long-term reuse, and one of those we've heard from Penny earlier, it's the concept of renewable energy systems for long-term cleanup and future economic benefit. Often if we do an economic analysis, and a question related to this came up earlier, an economic analysis of a renewable energy to power a treatment system, often we don't get the return necessary over the lifespan of that treatment system, but if that infrastructure is left on place for reuse after we have completed the project, it starts to make a lot more sense. Of course, there are some issues with property transfer specific to each cleanup program and who's paying for the cleanup, et cetera, but to the extent that we can think this through upfront and build, install a renewable energy capacity on the site and transfer it to the reuse of the site, it starts to make a lot more economic sense to power both the remedy and whatever the reuse is of the site with the renewable energy. And then last bullet here, maximizing natural carbon sequestration potential. Again, for those of you who have a specific interest in this, I invite you to revisit the Earth Day seminar. The folks are continuing to work on that, but we decided to replace that with that topic with the concept of voluntary cleanup standards. But we are continuing to research that. A lot of the work that's being done is in metrics and quantifying how much carbon is sequestered pre and post restoration of a site. And of course, public policy may take a different shift, and might move into some type of a credit system where if you do capture credit, you might carbon, you might want to take credit for it, et cetera. But just basically, the concept here is that if we go from bare soil to a fully functioning ecosystem, the soil profile will have more carbon in it, and long term, that carbon is likely to stay there. So we will be acre per acre. There's a potential to increase the carbon sequestration through site restoration. So if you go to slide number 44, again, I mentioned that a lot of the focus today when it comes to green remediation is on the energy use and carbon and climate change considerations. It's not the only one, but admit it is at the top right now. I wanted to share this slide with you. For those of you who have not seen it, this is an analysis we did of the five most energy-intensive treatment technologies in use in Superfund. So this is not across cleanup programs. This is only in Superfund. And based on the number of projects that are currently out there or are being selected by year and the information we have on how they are being operated, we ran this analysis and concluded that the average annual energy use of all these technologies is about 610,000 kilowatt hours, and the annual carbon footprint for the sum of these technologies is 404,000 metric tons of CO2. So again, we're not going to compare ourselves to, for example, any sectors like the waste management sector. It's orders of magnitude greater than we are. Transportation sector, orders of magnitude greater than this. That's not the point. The point is to identify for each of these technologies, starting with the most energy-intensive ones, what can we do to reduce their carbon footprint? It's not a matter of not using these technologies. It's a matter of identifying opportunities to reduce their energy and carbon footprint, because often these technologies provide a specific solution to a specific problem. But I do want to, however, mention that 404,000 metric tons is not insignificant. In fact, it's approximately 50% of NASA's carbon footprint. NASA's done an analysis of their carbon footprint as an agency, and it's on the order of 900,000 metric tons of CO2 per year. So this is not an insignificant figure. If we could go to slide number 45, I'm going to touch on a couple of examples of green remediation projects. The first one, this is a non-energy project. Actually, it's a soil vapor extraction system which relies on wind power to create a vacuum to draw a gas from landfill vents. That windmill runs a cylinder that's housed in that little hut down there. This is actually a RCRA corrective action site. It's not a Superfund site. And in the upstroke, that cylinder creates a vacuum, and then in the downstroke, shuts a valve, opens a valve, and the gas that's been pulled from below ground is pushed through activated carbon canisters, which is the treatment of that gas, and then vented to the atmosphere after having gone through those through that treatment system. So this is an exclusively off-grid operation, providing that post effect for carbon removal for removal of VOCs. Again, being soil vapor extraction, it's not critical that this operate 24/7. If there's a down period, that's okay. In fact, eventually it'll allow for a little bit of a rebound of VOC concentrations in soil gas. And when it starts pumping again, it'll pump at higher concentrations and get more return. And it's been very successful. This project, there's a profile of it on the greenremediation.org website. There's some more detail on this project. But basically, VOC concentrations in soil gas have been reduced over 90% in 5 years of operation. And on the profile on the website, there's also some detailed information on the energy savings, which are not insignificant. So that was just given the limited amount of time, I didn't want to go through too many projects. Again, more profiles are available on accruin.org/greenremediation. I want to move on a little bit more to open up the way for Deb's presentation and talk about the Osler green remediation strategy. The idea here is that for the purpose of advancing green remediation best practices or green cleanup best practices, because we recognize that remediation is a very super fun loaded term, so the concept here is green cleanups, not just green remediation. Across cleanup programs, OSWR seeks to benchmark and document green remediation best management practices across cleanup programs, and we've done a lot of that. A lot of the profiles that we have on the green remediation website come from multiple programs, and we can add to those. And if any of you have projects where you've adopted any of these best practices that we've described, I'd love to hear from you. We have resources to write them up and highlight them and put them on Cluin.org and also share them with our peers and your peers and anybody else who makes decisions and is in the position to adopt these best practices. So, again, if you know of any projects out here that you've used any of the core elements of green remediation, love to hear about you so we can write these up and benchmark and document them. Another is a sample of toolkit of enablers, and I have a slide a little bit further ahead where I highlight some of these, so I won't go into too much detail. But anyway, the point here is that there are a lot of tools for decision makers, not only in EPA, but in other programs and in other positions in the whole cleanup society, or that are necessary and can be used to foster the adoption of best cleanup practices. Then building networks of practitioners. This is an example, just this internet seminar. Again, recognize Illinois EPA and its SWAMO for bringing this all together. And then developing performance metrics and tracking mechanisms. That's at a very early stage, but definitely there's a lot of interest in that area to be able to determine whether or not we're doing the better practice of putting green remediation or green cleanup best practices in place. So there's several groups working in that area. If I can talk about slide 47, why strategy. It's important for us to have a common understanding for better internal communication. As many of you probably experienced, EPA cleanup programs are varied, and we have different faces, RCRA corrective action, underground storage tanks, brownfields, Superfund, et cetera. But there is a common understanding across all of them in when it comes to green remediation and green cleanups, and we need to understand a common position so that when we communicate with external parties, we're all saying the same thing and recognize that that's very important for us. In having a unified voice position when working with regulated parties. As well as another point is developing shared goals and better measuring and communicating progress. We're advancing that direction. We're not there yet, but that's the concept behind the strategy, at least when it comes to EPA. And then it helps us leverage similar efforts with other organizations, such as ITRC, CERDEP, SWAMO, Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable, and others. Can I just go to slide 48, please? One of the questions that often comes up, even with internal audiences as well as external parties, is why we're here to protect human health and environment. What is this story about green remediation? Well, it is part of our job, and you know, Sarah pointed out Executive Order 13423 earlier on strengthening federal environmental energy and transportation management. And literally, the first paragraph, if you read it, it clearly it hits home when it comes to green cleanups. And it's the concept of federal agencies will, in support of their missions, do it in an environmentally, economically, fiscally sound, integrated, continuously improving, efficient, and sustainable manner. So definitely it calls for us to do our job and clean up sites in a sustainable manner, following green cleanup principles and best practices. And then specifically, I have a couple of examples here of where we are as far as EPA's strategic plan. Also wanted to mention that EPA's 2009-2014 strategic plan is currently out for public comment. You can see it at epa.gov, downloaded, and again, it's open for public comment. There is some language in there regarding green cleanups, so here's an opportunity for you to provide input on whether you think it's important or not for the agency to incorporate these concepts into its strategic plan. So if we could go to slide number 49, a quick mention, we're not the only ones working on this. I have about 15 groups on this slide that are currently working on green cleanups. I'm not going to go through any of them in too much detail, but just to highlight a couple, the Superfund Remediation Work Group, that is looking at green cleanups in the Superfund. What are policy implications, what are technical requirements, training, et cetera. Another one is the Aswamo Greener Cleanups Task Force, and maybe we'll leave a few minutes at the end. I think Heather Nafong leads that one up and see if there's anything she wants to let us know about that effort. ITRC will be at the FRTR meeting next week when it comes to states, and they'll be presenting their green remediation team, which is being established. I believe it's starting this winter. And then finally, the Sustainable Remediation Forum, that's a group that's had 8 meetings so far. It's an ad hoc group. If you need more information on them, they don't really have a URL, so you'll have to send me an email. I can get you in touch with the right people. But they have periodic meetings, developing white paper on green cleanups. It does have a lot of focus on remedy selection, but it's participated by consulting engineering firms, by site owners, by states, federal agencies, and state agencies. So let's go to slide number 50, the Green Remediation Toolkit. I mentioned earlier, I touched on this. I have some a listing of existing tools and some that are in the pipeline. Some of the existing tools are the Green Remediation Primer. I'll touch on that in a minute. And the Green Remediation website, which has profiles and projects and case studies. We've had many internet seminars, not many, but quite a few. There was one last week which is one of a series of 3, and that replicates material that was delivered at the National Association of Remedial Project Managers meeting in Portland, Oregon this summer. There was an 8-hour training for federal RPMs, and a lot of that material is being rebroadcast given the level of interest we received on it. Tech support for Fed and State Project Managers, that's still available. If you have an interest, go to the Green Remediation webpage, gluon.org/greenremediation. There's a button there to solicit tech support. We have a certain amount of limited funding available to basically do a white paper looking at a project at any stage, evaluating what the green remediation opportunities might be. The idea here is to document those ideas, capture them, and do tech transfer. So, again, if you have a project that's at an interesting phase, please go to clune.org/green remediation and get in touch with us. The contracts toolkit for remedial action contracts. The concept here is incorporating the language and contracts that EPA places, but this applies to anybody. And what it does, that toolkit does, is looks at the whole procurement phase from the RFP through the execution of a contract, and where in that whole process we can include language that fosters, encourages, incentivizes, and recognizes green remediation best practices on the part of the consulting engineering firm that takes on the work. And then I have a couple more, not a couple, but I have a few products in the pipeline. I think Penny might have mentioned the MOU with National Renewable Energy Lab, excuse the typo there. But one of the major ones is the Cleanup Voluntary Standards Program, which is a relatively long-term effort. We're at the very early stages of it, and I'm going to let Deb Goldblum elaborate further on that. So going to slide number 51. This is the green remediation primer I mentioned earlier. It provides an introduction to the best practices as we've heard about them today. It looks at green remediation, green cleanups across regulatory frameworks, and was released in April 2008, and you can either download it or order a hard copy. I did print hard copies because I know lots of us will get a lot more out of it, so that's the green part of printing it. And they can be downloaded or ordered on clune.org/remediation. And that is my last slide, which is the URL to the Green Remediation webpage. And with that, I'll hand it over to Deb. And Deb, I'm sorry if I stepped a little bit on your time.
Okay, Carlos. So it's a smart crowd, and I'm going to go really fast. We are on 553. It's a two-part talk. My name is Deb Goldblum. I work in Region 3's Retro Corrective Action Program. The first part of the talk is going to talk about a pilot I worked on, which, again, I'm going to run through this very quickly, given our time, and I'm going to leave time for questions. You can always email me later. The second part tells you the point of a pilot is to learn things, and we learned a lot. And then from that pilot, we had some ideas, and now we have a collaborative partnership with many individuals, organizations, and that's part of a green cleanup standard, and we'll talk about that secondarily. So let's go to slide 54. As I mentioned, I'm in the Record Corrective Action Program, and we have three threshold criteria for any remedy, and then we have seven balancing criteria. To have a remedy, you must pass the threshold criteria for us to pick it. And then we weigh these other factors. The idea with the pilot was, could we add a sustainability factor into our assessment? Now, this is very different than what Carlos said. Carlos said we're only going to optimize remedies. And actually, in this, you know, we're living on the edge in the regions. We said, no, we're going to use it as one of the many factors. It wasn't mean do nothing versus something. It was, hey, if we have several remedies that are potentially okay, for example, soil vacuum extraction and bioremediation, which one is truly the best? Next slide is 55. So first we had defined sustainability. We had a lot of ideas. And next slide, on slide 56, we'll see many ideas. We refined it to this. We were going to look at greenhouse gases and energy, and we had some metrics there, resource consumed and recycled. We had metrics there. Slide 58. To picture the Martinsville site in Virginia, it's 550 acres. It's a DuPont facility. It operated from 1941 to 1998. This is an old picture. They manufactured nylon there. Most of it's been raised. At the end of the investigation, three areas weren't in cleanup. I'm going to focus on one of them, Unit H1, which is in the far northern part of the site. Next slide. So we're on slide 59. So we came up with an idea, actually DuPont came up with this idea, and we massaged it, of using a credit debit approach to look at sustainability, and this is our sustainability factor. What's different about this is we use life cycle analysis to assess the environmental outcome of the cleanup, and we also had quantifiable results. Typically the only thing I see quantifiable is cost. Everything else in a remedy selection, at least the ones I look at, just are qualitative. We had some challenges coming up with this matrix. I'm not even going to go into that. If you look at the carbon dioxide road, focus on that. What I mean by life cycle analysis, if you look at the debit, we didn't look just at the fuel and energy for the cleanup, but we looked at the fuel and energy for manufacturing the consumable, and then what's generated by the management of residuals and the sequestration loss by vegetation. And again, I know I'm going quickly. Send me emails later if you have questions. Slide 60. For any remedy, you go through some steps. You know, you have the product data, one. You get your remedial options, two. What's different about this approach we did, three, the calculation module, and I'll walk you through it expeditiously. Step one, next slide, slide 61. This was a former Finnish oil pond. You can see a picture in the 1970s, and in 2004, it's small. It's 100 feet across. It had an impacted area about 4.5 feet. It was impacted with VOCs and PCBs, some other stuff. Next slide. So we went through our options. We said the objective is you're going to clean up the drinking water fins throughout the plume. We're going to do it through a combination of source control, treatment, and MNA. We put a lot of ideas on the board, and we came up with five options. Those are the five options in front of you. They all pass the threshold criteria. Next slide. Slide 63. What we had to do then is identify, I'm going to go through for one of those remedies, and we're looking at just the zero valent iron. That was one of the remedies that passed the criteria, and that's where you mix soil with bentonite to destroy the VOCs and iron to destroy the VOCs and bentonite to stabilize the other contaminants. So we're on slide 63, and so for the DVI, what you had to do, because it's using a life cycle analysis approach, you need to figure out all your steps. You need the materials you need for the remedy. You need the transportation for the materials to the site. You need to know about the fuel for the equipment at the site. You need to know the number of people you're going to have at the site, the days they work, the fuels going to the site. There are lots of assumptions in this. We're going to continue with step three on slide 64. Once you identify that, you identify all the components, you also need to know the volumes for all the steps. So you're going to identify all the fuel that goes into the remedy to be implemented. You're going to separate the gasoline from the diesel separately, because what we're working through is how to figure the carbon footprint. And so I'm just a step back. So it's like we're looking at the carbon footprint for one of the options under consideration. And so we looked at, you separate gasoline and diesel because actually if you use life cycle analysis techniques, they have a different carbon footprint emission. And then we also looked at the consumables. And so the pointed slide, slide 65, is the next slide. And I've circled values that are available on the internet through NREL for total pounds of CO2 emitted for using 1,000 gallons of diesel and the total pounds of CO2 emitted using 1,000 gallons of gasoline. And so you see those have different values, and the point is that you can take, if you know how much gasoline and diesel you're using as part of implementing a remedy, you can convert that to carbon ton equivalent with a little, you know, conversions and being careful with your numbers. There are also numbers available for consumables, and that is also provided in the sheet. The point of the sheet is just to show you that there are different sources out there, and there are numbers available. Now, we did have challenges. There's some consumables we could not find new values readily available, and then we had to ask for some help with some life cycle analysis experts. So if we go to slide 65, the next step is step three, and we took the fuel, and we multiply by the conversion factor, and we take the consumables, multiply by the conversion factor, and we could estimate in carbon ton equivalents what was released, would be released over this remedy, the life of the remedy, implementing and operating for the ZVI treatment, and that was 170 carbon ton equivalents. And then we estimated 5 carbon ton equivalents based on assumptions like quarterly for 2 years, and then semi-annually out a few years, and then annually out to some 30 years. Again, there are a lot of assumptions here, but that was what we came up with. So it was 175 carbon ton equivalents as an estimate for implementing this one remedy at this one part of the site. Slide 67. You'll see it says step 4, sustainability factors. This is going back into the matrix. And the reason I walked you through the carbon dioxide row is because that one seems to be the most interesting for this site because it's very small. That seemed to be the most important. At other sites, the other factors, the resource conservation, in fact, may be more important. I saw BP do one where it was the land use one that really played into it. So I just wanted to give people a sense of what was done. But you can see, again, we have values here for all the boxes on the matrix. So if we go to slide 68, you'll see carbon ton equivalent. Again, I had five. We had five remedies for these sites, and we were able to estimate what the carbon footprint would be to implement these remedies. Gross estimates. Murphy's Law is always in the way. There's way too many significant figures here. You could look at these as orders of magnitude. What you should also think about is this is not the only criteria we use. First of all, we had the threshold criteria to help us figure out which remedies are even appropriate for the site. Okay, and then we had the factors, and this was just one of many of the balancing factors. And in fact, we didn't pick the one with the lowest carbon footprint. Actually, ZVI in situ treatment was picked and not tapping because it was the best remedy for that situation. So it's not the only thing you should look at. Slide 69. People thought it led to more innovation, it's collaborative, more robust. On the flip side, it can be dangerous. There's lots of assumptions. And the biggest concern I had is that every site, we would slow down our cleanups because this is a really involved process. Like DuPont has resources to do this, and we had some support from headquarters to help us look at this evaluation. We can't do this everywhere. So we learned a lot. We figured, where do we go from here? Next slide, slide 70. Well, one potential solution was to develop a green cleanup standard. What we thought about is we could, like, mimic the LEED idea, which helped people to think more broadly, I think. If you look at a regular remedy selection criteria, whatever cleanup program it is, it really doesn't consider climate change or the limited resources of the planet. And so there is no intuitive connection to help people think more broadly. If we put out something that helped people think more broadly, it would help foster greener cleanups across not just RCRA, but all the cleanup programs. Slide 71. So in the region here, we developed a one-pager of the idea. We started to float it around to see if we get interest. Coincidentally, headquarters offered some funding for proposals that would support green remediation, and actually, so our proposal was funded. Carlos's group helped us out by doing a benchmark report of some other voluntary programs out there, and we now have a work group established. So we're in the early stages of exploring developing a green cleanup standard. Slide 72. The objective of the green cleanup standard is we really hope to help people think more broadly. So I think just by going through that kind of carbon evaluation process helps the entire group think about what they did differently. We want to foster practices through incentives. We want to, for example, promoting renewable energy use. We want something that could be universally used across all cleanup programs so those who are implementing it aren't stuck with doing one thing in one state and something else in another state and something else in a different program. We don't want to contradict the regulatory programs that we're currently working, and this should work with the existing regulatory framework, and we want to show measurable results. Slide 73. Also think the timing's right. We did do a lot of outreach to stakeholders, the people who do the cleanup, and corporations are really interested in showing social responsibility. They're developing their own internal green goals. There are new tools being developed all the time. For example, the engineering firm is working on some calculators to estimate your energy input for different remedies. Obviously, people in the states know there are different state and local government incentives being developed. It would be great if everybody could look towards one standard. The U.S. Green Building Council has shown, indicated they have interest in our developing a standard. And if nothing else, it gives us, it instigates constructive dialogue about what it is and what we want to promote across the cleanup programs to be a greener cleanup. Next slide. So, as I said, we're in the early stages, and I think the programs need to evolve. In the 90s, we were just cleaning up sites. In 2000, we're moving towards, okay, let's think about cleanup and reuse. And now we want a green cleanup, and we want sustainable use. Thanks. Time for questions.
All right, thank you. That was quick.
I know. We have 10 minutes.
I know when you sent us the slides, you were worried about not having enough time, so. We do have a few questions online here. I think a couple of these are for open. I guess we're open to all the presenters here. Does the fact that one has plans to site a green energy production facility at a contaminated site impact the amount of cleanup undertaken? If so, can you explain?
I can answer that. This is Penny McDaniel. No, it doesn't. The primary goal is to get the site cleaned up in accordance with the cleanup standards. And if a green or renewable energy facility is planned or being thought about for a redevelopment option, That's great, but that doesn't affect the actual cleanup of the site. So I hope that answers the question. Was that clear?
I think so.
Okay.
Is there anybody on the phone lines? Unmute your phone and ask a question if you have a question.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, this is Jennifer Griffith at NMOA, and I'm just wondering with the last presentation, just how we can keep track of what's going on in terms of actually developing calculators and that whole remedy selection criteria evaluation. How can we keep
so different things. If you want to, with regard to the green cleanup standards or all the things that are happening across the agency with regard to green cleanups, what are you asking about?
No, more specifically the remedy selection and the tools and the calculators to analyze.
I think it's the best place, but Carlos, unless you have another suggestion.
No, Jennifer, we actually compiled a list of basically calculators that have been developed or under development out there. I'd be glad to email it to you. It's just an internal reference. It's not really a publication.
Right. Where should we plug in? Because NMOA is an association of the Northeast states, the six New England states, New York and New Jersey, and all our states are interested in this, and I just like to be able to keep them as up to date as I can. So, you know, how do we know when something new comes around or...
Well, everything that we're aware of, we're publishing on Fluent.org, Green Remediation. Okay. Actually, there's a new website coming up, I think, in January. But everything that we become aware of, we post there.
Okay.
As far as developments, more media developments, I think that's more, as usual, a matter of networking. And that's the purpose of this call.
All right, thanks.
Hi, this is Heather Nifong. I just wanted to thank all the presenters and US EPA generally for hosting this and repeating some of the sessions. I think it's going to be very helpful. And also to pick up on Jennifer's question, with the ASUAMO Greener Cleanup Task Force, on the ASUAMO webpage, we do have a page where we are listing links to various states and also other public resources. It includes the Green Remediation Primer document that Carlos presented. And so if you go to the ASUAMO.org website, if you scroll down a bit, there's a direct link on the main page now to Greener Cleanup Resources.
Are there any other questions from the phone lines?
I have a question. Has anybody given a thought to adaptation to climate change in remediation systems? Because so far all the presentations are really with respect to mitigation efforts, lowering emissions and impacts, but I think that some of the engineering assumptions that are used in calculating and using modeling and some of the assumptions could be in fact changing, especially for the longer cleanups. So I'm speaking just in case in terms of runoff and droughts, water tables, flooding, flood zone changes. Is anyone looking in the remediation program at the effects, the long-term effects of changing weather patterns in the United States?
I think, Dorothy, is Dorothy asking the question?
Yes.
This is Carlos. Of the groups that I had on my presentation, that blue screen, with 15 different organizations or groups working. One of them is climate change and contaminated lands, which is an EPA effort in Osware, in the Office of Solid Waste Emergency Response. And again, it's looking across programs at climate change and contaminated lands. A lot of the effort that Penny is undertaking comes out of that, actually Penny's associated with that office right now. But that work group has five teams. And one of the teams I was recently organized in a meeting in Philadelphia last month has to do with adaptation to climate change. So what is it about climate change and how will it affect the way we operate remedies, both existing and future? So it's at a very preliminary stage, but at least in EPA, that's the group that's looking at that consideration.
That's slide 49?
I don't remember because the printout I have is not numbered. It's the blue slide that's titled remediation information.
Yeah. And what, which is the group?
It's CCCL. Climate
okay,
change
thank you.
And lands.
And before we take any more questions, I'd like to remind everybody that's still listening, if you go to slide 76, there's links to the additional resources and, importantly, the feedback form. If you go and fill out the feedback form, you can, at the end of filling it out, you'll be taken to a screen that you can print off to verify that you sat in on today's seminar. Are there any more questions from the phone lines?
I have one question. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
This is Bob Strauss from Wisconsin. I'm just curious, since oftentimes siting of wind farms, wind turbines, whatever, creates a lot of negative public sentiment, is there any discussions about environmental justice and how we are, you know, we could be saddling these same poor local residents with now a burden of a wind turbine in their vicinity. I personally don't feel wind turbines are a negative attribute for a community, but I know that that perception is out there.
Yeah, hi, this is Penny, DPA. You know, we're not looking specifically at that issue, but that is something that if a site were to be looked at specifically for renewable energy development, that would be something that is a factor that would be considered. You know, I guess I would have to also stress, though, that I guess seeing a wind turbine versus seeing a smokestack would be, you know, I would think in any community a wind turbine would be more welcome than perhaps a coal power plant, you know, stack spewing smoke, but I know that there are sensitivities around siting such facilities, renewable energy facilities, and I do think that would be a consideration in a site-specific situation, but it isn't something that we've looked at in terms of screening out sites or anything like that with this tool.
I'm just suggesting that maybe through some outreach or whatever, we can actually build this as reverse environmental justice, and through modernization, mm-hmm. the locals might have a significant benefit.
Yeah, I agree.
They live in a modern community with solar panels instead of the black eye of a Superfund site or what have you next door. So.
Yeah, right. And that's a really, really good point. And I'm sensitive to that in kind of the outreach materials that we produce. And we'll definitely keep that in mind and try to really revisit some of the materials that we're producing to see if we can, you know, reframe this a little bit in a better, greater light, I guess, a better light than perhaps it is right now. So I appreciate that comment. Thank you.
We had a question that came in. I thought that I think asked for clarification on sort of the certified or verified aspect. The question is, what do you mean by certified green cleanup? Is it tied into the ETV program?
Tied into the what program?
ETV program.
What ETV is?
It's the Environmental Technology Verification Program that's run through ORD, I believe.
First of all, I'll just talk about standards development. Standards are not developed by EPA per se. We're not actually allowed to as a result of something called the Federal Technology Transfer and Advancement Act, which was enacted in 96. What we can do is EPA, coordinated with the states, can develop straw metrics, which we will then shop around to standard developing organizations who will then, such as, for example, ASTM is one, who then will have the standard, and then there's something, the compliance with the standard is the certification. And then agencies and states will have to decide if they want to recognize the standard and how they want to certify it or verify its compliance, and that could be through something like a self-certification or it could be through a third-party certification. And so just that's how it should move forward. But I don't know about its ETV program, but maybe I should.
It's referring to somebody had a technology or whatever that it would be verified against that standard. But yeah, I think you answered the question to what we were trying to get to. I think we have one more here that sort of is related. I don't think we have anybody from Alston, but I think this idea pertains to all the programs in regards to time and sort of speed of remediation. And the question is, what about natural attenuation? This appears to me to be one of the most, desired methods with impacts to the environment and energy use. Yet EPA ALS wants faster cleanups of leaking underground storage tank sites. It appears to me that what we are talking about today is in conflict with what ALS is pushing.
This is Carlos. If I could take that one, and then maybe Deb wants to take a jab at it too. That's the whole idea of in that definition slide at the bottom, the italicized text about it's about remedy implementation. Again, natural attenuation is can be an option. In fact, in EPA, it's been selected more and more often as a complement to a more active remedy. But even in the case of natural attenuation, the monitoring system that's put in place as the monitoring part of natural attenuation, there are opportunities to reduce the environmental impact of how that is done using remote sensing, using automatic loggers, using best practices in the monitoring part of it that are quote-unquote greener than practices that we have used in the past. So this comes back to that issue of remedy selection. The way the question is phrased, it seems to pitch M&A against a more active remedy. That's not necessarily what we're looking at this point, although we are evolving tools to get to the point where we can do a comparison, but we're not there yet. So it's more about putting a remedy in place in the case of underground storage tanks. Is it SPE? Is it bioremediation? Is it in situ oxidation? Whatever the actual, or dig and haul, whatever the actual remedy is, what is it about putting it in place that we can do to reduce its environmental impact?
I am going to add up. A clean site is clearly more sustainable. Cleaning up sites is a more sustainable approach than leaving it there long term. Reducing our long term obligation, if you go back to the definition in the beginning, meaning to meet the needs in the future, is really a part of this. And so the idea that we shouldn't be cleaning up sites is not. It's sustainable is to clean up a site. And it is a tricky part about balancing our energy use and also cleaning up our sites. But it's also not just, we shouldn't just focus on energy, because I think there are a lot of other activities that we can do that also affect sustainability. So it's a bigger question than that simple, okay, it's energy or energy use or M&A. And I think also from the record perspective, for us it was fairly easy because we have a threshold criteria of having source control as a goal. And so that's different than some other programs that sort of takes away this issue that you're going to do something for the source. So contaminant destruction could be a goal of a sustainable remedy. You know, that's potentially an option. It's just a broader thing than just energy alone and should not be looked at in a vacuum because it does not consider the value of cleaning up the site.
Thank you. I think we've gone past our time here, so we're going to wrap things up and say
thank
you.
I've got a question.
Okay, real quick.
Yeah, real quick, this is Hernando Alvarez from Illinois.
Thanks for using WebEx. Visit our website.
First of all, the presentations today were great, a lot of good information in them. My question, and it's more of a comment perhaps, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on developing clean energy, renewable energy on the contaminated land, which is needed very badly, there's no doubt about that. But I'm wondering is there a concern about putting too much emphasis on that and forgetting about other uses, other potential benefits or uses of the property. Does anybody else share that concern?
This is Penny. I'll just take a shot at that. Definitely the initiative to encourage development of renewable energy is not at the expense of redevelopment of other types of infrastructure. Homes or businesses or anything like that. This is just simply being offered up as another alternative, and frankly, for many of the sites, they wouldn't qualify for kind of other traditional types of redevelopment, like for commercial buildings or houses or hospitals or things like that. So particularly for those sites, this would be a great redevelopment option. But the intent is definitely not to be taking away from other traditional redevelopment possibilities.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and this is Jennifer Griffith at NMOA. I feel bad for the people that got off the phone early, because I think some of the best comments and discussions have been here at the in the last 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay, well, if there's any more, thank you. But if there's any more questions, you can feel free to send an email to the presenters. The emails are listed on the site homepage or the seminar homepage. And don't forget to fill out the feedback form. I'd like to say thanks to all the presenters today, and thank you, everybody, for attending and participating.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.